One, two.
This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of culture from your friends at NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, editor for NPR's arts and entertainment blog, Monkey See.
And I'm Felix Contreras, reporter for NPR's arts desk and jazz blogger for A Blog Supreme.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
we'll have a conversation with Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, who were once basketball's biggest rivals but now are close friends, and they're the subject of a new book.
Then underground cartoonist R. Crumb on his latest project, a graphic novel interpretation of the Bible. And Napoleon Dynamite director Jared Hess returns with his latest film, Gentlemen Broncos. But first,
the Obamas, they're way too classy to get all up in people's faces. So you know what? I hereby appoint myself the president's tell people where to go and what the kisses are.
That was Wanda Sykes. This past weekend, she debuted her new Saturday night talk show on Fox. And Monday, comedian George Lopez started four nights a week on TBS. Sykes and Lopez are entering territory dominated by familiar white men. Leno, Letterman, Conan. Add on Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, and Craig Ferguson, and you have six white guys in suit jackets interviewing celebrities after the kids go to bed. Felix, you had a story this week about the developments in late-night television.
Yes, I did.
Let's listen to that.
When George Lopez and Wanda Sykes do their HBO stand-up specials, they're talking directly to people who speak the same language.
White people are looking at you.
If immigration's law passed, they say that 1.2 million Mexicans would have to go back to Mexico. 1.2, ¿sabes qué? That's seven quinceañeras.
I mean, my wife is French. You know, she's French. I like to say she's French because it sounds nicer than white.
Governor Schwarzenegger is for English only. Okay, that's good. But you know, the problem there is you don't speak English.
They can also be more family friendly. For 5 years on ABC, George Lopez was a Latino version of every sitcom dad.
You know you're not supposed to touch my guitar. This is a vintage Les Paul.
It's a Los Palo. You got it at the swap meet.
Yeah, well, it's still a collector's item. Only 100 were made before they raided the factory and freed the children.
But can the edgier side of Lopez and Sykes make a mark on the homogenous world of late-night TV?
They'll have to push some boundaries.
Eric Deggans is a television writer for the St. Petersburg Times. He says Lopez has been creating a more inclusive perception of mainstream on his sitcom and his stand-up work.
He's able to reflect the mainstream through the eyes of a Mexican-American in a way that, you know, other Hispanics enjoy it, but also somebody like me, who's African-American, can see it and sort of say, wow, you know, I understand why that's funny.
George Lopez says he gets it.
You know, the mainstream America does not look like what people consider to be the mainstream. We live in a different America, and this show is for the new America.
Lopez peppered his sitcom with Spanish, assuming all of his audience would get it, and it wasn't always polite.
The point is, we need Lopez. So any Lopez would do.
Well, hell, we had a Rodriguez, but he could pass for Italian.
You, look at you. You are a dark brown Mexican hermano. Oh, yeah? Well, you can watch these dark brown Mexican nalgas walking away from you.
Orale, or okelachi, you know, or that stuff, my nalgas, or huevos even, you know, huevos and all that stuff that we use that people, they just understand.
George is calling it like it is.
Michael Wright is in charge of TBS's first run at late night TV, Lopez Tonight.
Sometimes that might lead him to a place that's pretty provocative, and my feeling about that is relevant, terrific comedy often has to sort of, you know, surprise you a little bit that way.
The last time late night TV shows offered that kind of edginess was 1994, when another African American comedian ended his late night TV run. For 5 years, Arsenio Hall worked a demographic that was younger, more black, and interested in more than white male hosts. But TV writer Deggan says a lot has changed since Hall's show went off the air. Hip-hop has become mainstream. Blacks and Latinos are more visible in Hollywood. And Deggans isn't sure Lopez and Sykes have their fingers on the pulse of what's young and hip.
George is 48. Wanda's 45. Can these guys be the voice of a new generation in the way that Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock and Arsenio were in their day? You know, we'll see.
George Lopez's first week of guests will be a mix of Black, Latino, and white Hollywood, reflecting his goal of getting a broad audience for both inclusiveness and ratings. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
You know, I watched the debut show on Monday of George Lopez, and I saw a little bit of the Wanda show on Saturday. And it's really clear just how tough of a job being a talk show host is. I mean, it's like you almost have to be bland and invisible to bring out the guests. And it's interesting to watch, you know, when Jimmy Fallon started, just to watch them how they try to pull that off, but yet have some kind of personality and presence.
I think it's an extremely difficult job, and you can sort of tell in part by how few people have turned out to be good at it and how many people have turned out not to be good at it, including people who had reputations as being strong in at least some area of comedy or variety performance.
It's a combination of marketing, combination of talent and timing.
It's definitely not for everybody, and you know, they all bring a slightly different approach to it.
I think it all comes back to Johnny Carson.
Oh, absolutely.
And how good he made it look easy.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, speaking of icons, there's another icon, R. Crumb. He may be best known as one of the fathers of the underground comics like Zap and Despair, and for characters like Devil Girl and Fritz the Cat. But his latest project may change all that. R. Crumb spent the last several years in an ambitious effort to illustrate the Book of Genesis. And he leaves nothing out, all 50 chapters, from Eden to Egypt, with every single begat. Crumb spoke to NPR's Neil Conan about why he decided to take on such a big project.
I started out for years, I was playing around with this kind of satire of Adam and Eve. I did a lot of sketches and preliminary stuff, and wasn't satisfied with it. So I decided, well, the story is so interesting on many levels in and of itself and lends itself to lurid illustration, I just decided to go ahead and do it straight. But then once I got into it, I realized I had taken on a huge task. You know, once I got past Adam and Eve, the flood, and, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah, I thought, oh my God, now I'm in for it. Now I got to do the whole soap opera of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob and Rachel and all that, all the way to the end. But it was interesting. Interesting job.
Did you lay out each page in advance, saying we're going to do this panel here and this was going to be on this page? Or did you draw panel by panel and then...
Yeah, I pretty much work panel by panel. Sometimes I do a preliminary pencil sketch of each panel. I actually did hundreds of those. And, and somebody asked me, they had a big show of the original art in the Hammer Museum in L.A. And they said, did you do any pencil sketches? And I said, yeah, I did a lot of them, but I threw them away. They said, oh, no.
These are worth millions.
Yeah, people want to see those. I said, nah, they weren't any good. They're unboring. Threw them away.
One of the things that will astonish people, as everybody who's read the Book of Genesis every time remembers all of the dozens and dozens of begats, and it is fascinating to see how you have created individual characters out of each and every one.
Yeah. Well, I decided, you know, that was a problematic part of the whole thing, the begats, and I decided to not just make a big block of text saying so-and-so begat so-and-so, because then if you do that, just a block of text, people will pass over it. So you want to actually make the begats significant and important, too, by showing each of these generations as an individual, as a person, you know, and just show the family lineage. That's a very important part of Genesis and, you know, the Hebrew tradition. That's what it's all about. It's very tribal, you know, so they're reciting the generations from Adam all the way down. And, you know, they do it all the way down to Jesus, actually.
Yeah. And where did you get the inspiration for the individuals? Are they people from your family or are they from books? Where?
Old issues of the National Geographic magazine. That's where a lot of it came from.
And the clothing?
Lots of different places. Some of that came from, you know, the Ten Commandments, the Cecil B. DeMille, you know. I had a friend of mine who was willing to run the DVDs, freeze frame them, and take photos. He took hundreds of photos, still photos, from Ten Commandments and some other biblical epics like that, The Mummy and Intolerance by D.W. Griffith. And those were very useful, actually, even though it might not be precisely authentic, but, you know, who knows what things really look like in 2000 B.C. There's very little visual evidence from that time, especially for Mesopotamia. For Egypt, there's more, but for what is now Iraq, in, you know, the year 2000 BC, there's very little.
You can hear the full interview with R. Crumb at npr.org/culturetopia. Speaking of the Bible, let's talk noodles. The Wonder Chef David Chang is crazy for noodles, which are the centerpiece of his restaurant, New York City's Momofuku Noodle Bar. It's not unusual for lines to form out of the door at all hours of the day at Momofuku, his minimalist noodle shop.
Momofuku is also the name of Chang's new cookbook, and it explains not just how to cook the food at his famous restaurants, but how he developed that obsession with noodles. NPR's Michelle Norris spoke with Chang about his signature dish, ramen.
For people who think of ramen as the hard little packs that come $4 with the little foil flavor pack, that's not what you're talking about necessarily. When you talk about ramen, help us understand what you're thinking about, what you're talking about, what you're serving up at Momofuku.
Well, that was actually, you know, my first introduction to ramen is the same thing. And instant ramen, cup of noodles, or there's a brand in Japanese called Ichiban, and Korean it's called Shin Ramen. And these are all instant ramens. Contemporary ramen is totally different than what most Americans think ramen should be. And there's a variety of types. And when I lived in Japan in Izumi Tottori, I was introduced to the cult of ramen. I was sort of floored because people would queue up for 2 to 3 hours. And contemporary ramen right now is like called wafu ramen. It has a lot of dried fish and pork and chicken. You know, ramen's not one thing. There's many, many different types.
Yeah, you have an interesting equation. Ramen equals broth plus noodles plus meat plus toppings and garnishes.
That's it. That's simply it. And I think that's why people love it so much. You know, when they created instant ramen, it was, I think it was a smash because it was so accessible. And who doesn't like hot broth and noodles?
Now, you have a recipe in the book for ramen broth, which is quite a bit removed from those little flavor packets that you often use to flavor ramen. This is a long and arduous process. It starts with konbu, which is the dried kelp. It also includes 4 pounds of chicken, either whole, bird, or legs, 5 pounds meaty pork bones, 1 pound smoky bacon, best quality you can get your hands on, scallions, onions, carrots, a little bit of, you could use kosher salt, I guess, or soy sauce, you say, or mirin. This takes hours to do this. I mean, you have to let the pork bones, for instance, simmer for 6 to 7 hours, just, you know, at that step, which is step six. There are a few steps beyond that. Help us understand why it's worth it to put this much time and love into that special broth.
But it's worth it, but to me it doesn't seem like it's that much. Granted, it seems like a lot of ingredients, but you're making a tasty soup with different layers of flavor, and all you need is a big pot and just throw a bunch of the ingredients in.
You know, there are a lot of ingredients that go into making a soup, Linda, and a lot of ingredients go into making a movie.
That is absolutely true. Jared and Jerusha Hess are not your typical Hollywood power couple. The young filmmakers are known for their cult hit Napoleon Dynamite, but they're also happily married with 2 kids. They're members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and they live in Utah. That's where they shot their latest movie, Gentlemen Broncos. Alex Cohen has the story.
Jerusha and Jared Hess were first introduced by their mutual friend Aaron Rule when they were students at Brigham Young University.
And he said, Jerusha, I've got this perfect boy for you. He's so, so hairy, but he's going to make $1 million someday. And then we met and we fell in love quickly. I fell in love with that hair.
Jared Hess does have a bushy beard and mustache. Ever since he was a kid, he says he knew he wanted to be in the film industry. Jerusha needed a little bit of convincing.
She was an English major, and I told her to come join the film program because you didn't have to read long books, but you could watch movies and write about them, and it was easier.
And so she did. The couple's first project was a screenplay they wrote as newlyweds. Jerusha recalls being so poor at the time, they had to share one chair as they wrote.
There was a lot of tears. Every time he was like, I'm going to make movies, baby, I think I would just cry and be like, how are we going to afford to eat?
The couple scraped together $400,000 to make their film, Napoleon Dynamite, about a nerdy high school kid played by John Heder, whose hobbies include singing in sign language and sketching mythical creatures.
What are you drawing?
A liger.
What's a liger?
It's pretty much my favorite animal. It's like a lion and a tiger mixed, bred for its skills and magic.
Napoleon Dynamite wound up making more than $44 million at the box office. Not bad for a film that Jared Hess says was based on his own adolescence in rural Idaho.
After my mom saw Napoleon Dynamite for the first time, she was like, well, that was a lot of embarrassing family material. But she, at the same time, was kind of flattered that it had made it into a movie.
The Hess's new film, Gentlemen Broncos, is based loosely on a cousin of Jerusha's. The comedy revolves around Benjamin Purvis, a homeschooled teen who writes a disturbing science fiction story called Yeast Lords. Benjamin winds up meeting his literary hero, a famous science fiction author named Ronald Chevalier. His trademark accessories are his Bluetooth earpiece and elaborate turquoise jewelry. In this scene, Chevalier explains to Benjamin how to improve sci-fi character names.
We can add Onius, Inus, or Anus to just about anything and it becomes magical. You, give me the name of one of your central protags.
Bronco.
I would lose the C immediately and I'd replace it with an L, Bronlonius.
Chevalier winds up stealing Yeast Lords and publishing it as his own. To make matters worse, local filmmakers turn it into a truly dreadful movie shot on VHS tape with cheesy effects. Once again, Jared Hess wrote what he knows.
A lot of my early film experiments were really lame videos of, like, I'd get a piece of plexiglass and paint various moons on it and have my brothers, you know, run through the shot with laser guns and lame things like that.
The Hesses still feature plenty of non-actors in their films. They send their casting director out to local Walmarts in Utah. But for the role of Dr. Ronald Chevalier, they went with Jemaine Clement of Flight of the Conchords fame.
I'll tell you a secret about anyone who makes comedy. They're nerds. They're all nerds.
Clement says Jared and Jerusha Hess understand the humor of situations where people don't quite fit in.
When I read reviews of their movies, if it's a good review, people will often say the Hesses have an obvious affection for their characters. And the bad reviews will say the Hesses have an obvious contempt for their characters.
He says the filmmakers have nothing but love for their misfits, nerds, and even the pompous story-stealing Dr. Chevalier. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen.
It's no secret that comedians are nerds.
I think that's true. Not a lot of popular athletes going into comedy.
Speaking of popular athletes, finally we're going to visit one of the greatest athletic rivalries in the history of basketball, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. For more than a decade, they dominated the game, first in college, then in the NBA. It was the Stoic versus the Showman, and it's all detailed in a new book called When the Game Was Ours. Magic and Bird spoke with Michelle Norris about how the two are now close friends.
Well, we disliked each other. It didn't help that we played in an NCAA championship game, and now we got to see each other in the NBA, and one is for the Celtics, one for the Lakers, because once we entered into both of those teams, they hated each other, the organizations already. So even our teammates made sure that we hated each other. I mean, we're so competitive anyway that there was a dislike there. I even hated him more because I knew he could beat me.
You know, some people look at the two of you and the way that your relationship has evolved over the years, and there's still this question, how much of that rivalry came from the two of you and the competition between the two of you, and how much of it was manufactured by the league?
Well, you got to go back in the 50s. We just rekindled the fire, but we did it in a way where we caught the imagination of everyone in America.
You know, I want to talk to you about a turning point in your relationship, and it seemed to be that moment when the two of you got together for the taping of the Converse shoe commercial. And before we go on, I think it'd be interesting if we just took a listen.
I heard Converse made a pair of Bird shoes for last year's MVP.
Yep.
Well, they made a pair of Magic shoes for this year's MVP.
Okay, Magic, show me what you got.
The Bird shoe, the Magic shoe. Choose your weapon from Converse.
We just heard the audio, so you don't see the visual, but Magic, you're in the limousine, and you jump out, and you know, you got the two shoes, and eventually they change the wording of that choose your weapon. But for a time, that commercial was legendary. How much did they have to convince both of you to get together to go to Indiana to tape that commercial?
Well, for you know, it was
probably
more.
I
know. It didn't take much convincing for you.
It was probably more for me than for Larry. You know, you got me going to his hometown, and Larry and I had never really sat down and had a conversation. So I'm nervous. You know, I'm nervous. It's like I'm going crazy. Like, what's going to happen? And we started shooting a commercial, and we really didn't say anything to each other. We were just, you know, doing our lines and everything. And the real moment, and I'm sure Larry would agree, was when we went up to the house for lunch. And his mom gave me the biggest hug and hello. And right then, she had me. And then Larry and I sat down for lunch. And I tell you, we figured out, you know, we're so much alike. We're from the Midwest. We grew up poor. Our families is everything to us. Basketball is everything to us. You know, those type of things. And so that changed my whole outlook on Larry Bird.
I was always nervous about when I played in the NBA. I always thought you had to keep the edge. A lot of things you do, you don't want to get too close to a person because you will get a little soft. But once me and Magic left that commercial shoot that day in Indiana, and once we got with our teams, all that was forgotten until we retired.
There's a chapter in this book that's called November 7th, 1991.
Because of the HIV virus that I have attained, I will have to retire from the Lakers today.
The chapter begins with the words, "You've got to call Larry." And that's Magic Johnson asking his agent at the time to call Larry Bird. Magic, there was a short list of people who you said had to know before you went before the cameras to make that announcement. But among all of your basketball colleagues, why was it so important to make sure that Larry Bird was at the top of that list?
Well, you know, probably for all the reasons we've been talking, we've been connected to each other since college. I knew that he would want to know and also want to know from me, and I'm glad that I was able to talk to Larry and let him know that I'm going to be okay, and I knew he was going to be supporting me, and I'm just glad that I was able to reach out to him.
Larry Bird, you still remember that phone call?
Well, it's something that I'll never forget my whole life, but, you know, we had a game that night, and I had my routine where I'd come home from shoot-around, have my lunch, then go take a nap, and right at, when I started to lay down there, the phone rang, and it was probably one of the worst feelings you ever could imagine. At that time, HIV was known to be a death sentence, but for some reason, when he told me he was going to be fine, I believed him, because everything he's ever said really come to be true. I felt a little bit better, but still, I was a gamer. I always liked to play in the games. I loved game day. I couldn't wait to get down to the gym. But when I got that call, that's the one time that I can honestly tell you that I didn't feel like playing.
We got a friendship. You don't have to talk every day, and we don't. And then when we do get together, when I see Larry and I get that pound and I get that hello, I'm good. You know, it takes me through my next year or two, you know, until I see him again.
A sports story by way of a book, but still one of the more fascinating relationships in our generation. And I thought Michelle did a great job with that.
Absolutely agree.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Linda Holmes.
And I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia.